Blog Talk Radio.
Seven feet barren, strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the roots. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South, them big bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia, clean and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck. The rain together, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the leaves.
Welcome to tonight's new feature, African Knowledge Beyond the Book Club. I'm your host, Charles. I'm joined by my lovely wife, the Wheels of Steel. Say hello, Jalavet.
Hello, Jalavet.
Right. Well, tonight we are starting a new feature, a new series. Actually, we'll be alternating between a contemporary text and a slave narrative from here on out, I believe. That will be something that we can get a great comprehensive, I would say, understanding of what our ancestors understood the relationship was between black folks and white folks. Because apparently since the 1960s, we have a gross misunderstanding of what our place is in this society. We believe a different paradigm is at work that is not real, which is, I would say, evident in the excitement some members of our nation after the flesh have for the Democratic National Convention and the presidential candidates, they still look for the power of the system of oppression to validate its political relevancy. And many want to be incorporated into that system of despotism. So those of you who want no part of that corruptible system, you may find interest in the program that we are hosting, that we are representing tonight.
We have two callers on the line tonight. We have Brother Mean, and we have a caller in the 504.
Okay. What's up, Brother Mean? Is he on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And what's up, 504, whoever that is?
How y'all doing? This is Nana.
Hey, I figured
all right.
It was, but I didn't want to have my face cracked.
I
mean, are
how
you there?
Doing,
I don't know if you're there.
Uh huh. Yeah. All right. We're ready.
I'm here. Okay. Can you hear me? All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Okay. We'll cover the preface of this particular narrative, and then we have time left. We'll get into the main body of the very first chapter. All right. Let's see. Here we have in the preface, here it goes. It says, in the month of August of 1841, I attended an anti-slavery convention in Nantucket. This is Manfred Douglas speaking. This must be someone else writing a letter about it. So there are a series of endorsements before the narrative begins. But we'll start with this endorsement by some abolitionist. But it's quite lengthy. So I guess we'll just skip it. Let's start at chapter one now.
May I add something?
Yeah.
I just wanted to add a few things before you all start, if you don't mind. The first thing is that what I wanted to say is that the slave narrative is the only authentic American literature. And what I mean by that is that it's the only genre that originated here, for the most part. Every other genre has originated, particularly in places like Europe and other spots, but so far as that particular genre, it originated here and it was written by ex-slaves. Secondly, no one has ever questioned the truthfulness of the narratives. Meaning that no one has ever gone back and say, well, Frederick Douglass was inaccurate at this particular spot, or Harriet Jacobs, or whatever the case may be. So these narratives, as a primary source, is pretty much like the absolute truth. And I just wanted to make that known, because there are some who might be listening and may doubt their stories. However, these narratives have stood the test of time, and no one has ever gone back and said that something was inaccurate, or that they did, or that they embellished, or did anything of the sort. So I just wanted to put that out there, that this is the truth that these former slaves wrote themselves. I just wanted to add that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you.
Just an uncontested work. We were listening to just today, we put out the verbal, I guess, searches that were available on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And, listening to these people speak about, their accounts of what happened. I think this was done in the 40s.
I know about that, yeah.
Yeah. And
that
you can just.
I'm sorry. Keep going. I'm sorry.
No. I was just commenting on how on one of the segments of Nightline, Ted Koppel actually said that himself. He said, this is just, it's so real, and it's so, you just know that, you know, you don't contest what these people are saying. You know that they are giving you an account of what happened from a very real place. You know, and he was basically saying the same thing that you were saying, that it is amazing, you know, listening to their accounts. You just know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to put that out there, especially the narratives that were written by the slaves himself or herself, particularly the one by Douglas, Jacobs, and Equino, that no one has ever disputed the truthfulness of their narratives. And I just wanted to make sure that it's put out there that what they have written is the truth, is undeniable. It's, you cannot contest it, no one. So I just wanted to put that out there. Unlike other books that have been written, i.e. the Bible or whatever, you know, people want to, you know, question what's the truth and go into translations or whatever the case may be. Well, this is nothing to be translated here. There's nothing to be interpreted here. It's written, and that's it. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Well, one thing to note is that they can be, I don't know how their works were contested in the 19th century, because some people could, people can make up anything and say, they wasn't really on this plantation, that plantation, bring her to this location, identify a person and kill them. You know, Frederick Douglass didn't even release the entire, he didn't release all the details until after, at least his expanded edition, until after the Emancipation Proclamation, after the war. So, because I think he was dealing with people trying to challenge the validity of his statements, you know, and those abolitionists were dealing with the Southerners trying to say, well, these basically a Negro's word is not to be taken, or why is a white
man? Well, I know that Harriet Jacobs, that's one of the first things that she addresses in her narrative, and so does Ordai Equano. One of the first things that they mention is that, you know, people are going to think that they're lying. But they're going to just tell their story, and then you could take it for what it's worth. And this is why I think even when Douglas mentioned about the fight that he has with Mr. Covey, and how it is that he won this fight, and he mentions names. But what I'm saying is that even then, when they wrote their narratives, no one questioned it. I mean, well, yeah, you could question the 21st if you like, but what I'm saying at that particular time, particularly with the first narrative that he wrote, which when he was fresh out the grease, you could pretty much say no one questioned it. It's only the, if you want to call them, rewrites after in the mid 1860s. It's not that they're questioning it. It's just that he expounds on a lot of things that he wrote the first time, because the first narrative is what you would call relatively short compared to the other ones. But so far as the crux of what happened to him and his story, that has yet to be refuted, and I'll wait for anyone to come and refute it. So until comes, you know.
Yeah, that's coming. You know, just like you said, the Bible, people want to contest it based on language, and people will contest it as it goes on increasingly. And I'm saying that they could have, and they will. As the slave masters become more popular, they're going to be slave owning sympathizers, and their African sympathizers, you know, black folks that sympathize with them, and they're gonna try to, you know, make up, manufacture any kind of dissonance, just like they do the Bible. People weren't contesting the historical relevance of information at the time, you know, because we're all witnesses to it. And so as time goes on, people start to forget things and they don't understand things the way they used to. And so then you can have a lot of questions as to, you know, what really happened. Was it really, did this really, you know, go on? So you had it happen over large periods of time and political motivations to create that kind of, I would say, dissension or the desire to invalidate histories and that sort of thing. So, like you said, they may have not done it. Of course, they didn't do it effectively, But what that we, because we do know that they, you know, we have all this evidence and we have this memorabilia, but they definitely want to at this point to question the relevance of the impact on what the, what our ancestors went through to the African African in America today, and that's the political foot, playground they're going to want to wage the battle. It's a that was a long time ago. That's got to do with you today, and that's totally false. Even they know that, but they know that the black African in America is so undereducated, alienated that he really doesn't know the relationship between then and now, his effect on his, you know, dealing with that, these old issues, his own spiritual and political devolution as a result of living under these conditions and not having an effective strategy to overcome these conditions. And they know that, you know, we are vulnerable to their psychic and attacks, and we haven't protected ourselves enough. So that's why I decided to bring this the slave narratives into higher focus in the African Knowledge Journal Book Club, because a lot of people who like to think that they're plural black, and then they don't really want to really deal with their history, whether it was positive and ancient or horrible and more recent. They're not really assimilating really anything. They're just skimming the surface, playing around with a bunch of history, throwing a little stuff out there, and not really getting into anything. You know, and so they, you know, we're going to get into everything, and everything needs to be I guess explored into depth, and I don't expect this to be a popular series. Expect it to be highly and it doesn't matter. The point is, it's going to be done, and so the blame will be on the people ignoring it, not mine. Because I had the means and desire to, you know, to arrange and explore this and talk about it, and many people who support or endorse our efforts to do so, and so many more who decide that, you know what, that makes me feel sad, I don't want to hear that, I'm already depressed enough, and I don't want to hear anything else that doesn't, you know, lift me up or my mood or what have you. Well, that's the attitude they're going to take. Well, their current situation will persist. And it'll, not only will it persist, but it will intensify.
Absolutely.
So the blame ain't going to be on us for not giving them the commentary, for not pointing out the texts that are interesting and they contain valuable information that they otherwise would not explore on their own. The work was done, and they'll have to stand before their creator and give that account as to why they didn't think it was important to understand their condition and take the appropriate action. And that's on them. So they can't look at us and hold that one down.
All right. Well, I'm ready. I just wanted just to put that out there, that this is, you know, that it's a primary source, and it's authentic, and it originated with us. So I'm ready.
All right.
Ready.
So, chapter 1, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, written by himself. I was born in Tuckahoe near Hillsboro, and about 12 miles from Easton in Talbot County, Maryland. I have no accurate knowledge of my age, never having seen any authentic records containing it. By far, the large part of slaves know as little about their age as hearts know of theirs. And it is the wish of most masters within my knowledge to keep their thus ignorant. I do not remember to ever have met a slave who could tell of his birthday. They seldom come nearer to it than planting time, harvest time, cherry time, springtime, or fall time. A want of information concerning my own was a source of unhappiness to me even during childhood. The white children could tell their ages. I could not tell why I ought to be deprived of the same privilege. I was not allowed to make any inquiries of my master concerning it. He deemed all such inquiries on the part of a slave improper and impertinent, and evidence of a restless spirit. The nearest estimate I can give makes me now between 27 and 28 years of age. I come to this from hearing my master say sometime during 1835, I was about 17 years old. My mother was named Harriet Bailey. She was the daughter of Isaac and Betsy Bailey, both colored and quite dark. My mother was of darker complexion than either of my grandmother or grandfather. My father was a white man. He admitted to be such by all I ever heard speak of my parentage. The opinion was also whispered that my master was my father, but of the correctness of this opinion, I know nothing. The means of knowing was withheld from me. My mother and I were separated when I was but an infant, before I knew her as my mother. It is a common custom in the part of Maryland from which I ran away to part children from their mothers at a very early age. Frequently, before the child reached its 12th month, its mother is taken from him and hired out on some farm a considerable distance away, and the child is placed under the care of an old woman, too old for field labor. For what this separation is done, I do not know, unless to be a hinder to the development of the child's affection toward its mother, and to blunt and destroy the natural affection of the mother for the child. This is the inevitable result. I never saw my mother, to know her as such, more than 4 or 5 times in my life, and each of these times was very short in duration and at night. She was hired by a Mr. Stewart, who lived about 12 miles from my home. She made her journey to see me in the night, traveling the whole distance on foot. After the performance of her day's work, she was a field hand, and a whipping is the penalty of not being in the field at sunrise, unless the slave has special permission from his or her master to the contrary, a permission which they seldom get, and one that gives to him that gives it the proud name of being a kind master. I do not recollect of ever seeing my mother by the light of day. She was with me in the night, and she would lie down with me and get me to sleep, but long before I awake, she was gone. Very little communication ever took place between us. Death soon ended that. Ended what little we could have. While she lived, and with her hardships and suffering, she died when I was about 7 years old. And on one of my master's farms near Lee's Mill, I was not allowed to be present during her illness, at her death, or burial. She was gone long before I knew anything about it, never having enjoyed to any considerable extent her soothing presence, her tender and watchful care. I received the tidings of her death and much of the same emotion I should have probably felt at the death of a stranger. Called us suddenly away, she left me without the slightest intimation of who my father was. The whisper that my master was my father may or may not be true, and true or false, it is of little consequence to my purpose, whilst the fact remains in all its glaring odiousness that slaveholders have ordained and by law established that the children of slave women shall in all cases follow the condition of their mothers, and this is done too obviously to administer to their own lust and to make a gratification of their wicked desires profitable as well as pleasurable. For by this cunning arrangement, the slaveholder, in cases not a few, sustained to his slaves a double relation of master and father. I know of such cases, and it is worthy to remark that such slaves invariably suffer greater hardships and have more to contend with than others. They are, in the first place, a constant offense to their mistress. She is ever disposed to find fault with them and can seldom do anything to please them. She is never better pleased than when she sees them under the lash, especially when she suspects her husband of showing to his mulatto children favors which he withholds from his black slaves. The master is frequently compelled to sell this class of his slaves out of deference to the feelings of his white wife, and cruel as the deed may strike anyone to be, for a man to sell his own children to human fleshmongers, it is often the dictate of humanity for him to do so, for unless he does this, he must not only whip them himself, but must stand by and see one white son tie up his brother of but few shades darker complexion than himself, and ply the gory lash to his naked back. And if the lisp of one word of disapproval is set down to the parental partiality, and only makes a bad master worse for both himself and the slave whom he will protect and defend. Does anybody have any comments on that?
Well, I do. I thought it was interesting how a lot of the interaction between the captive and the slaveholder actually was about thinking properly. They wanted to make sure that you didn't think too highly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You couldn't say certain things. Anything that would could possibly be contagious, any type of liberating or empowering thoughts.
Right. That's the very early thought policing done here in America on a grand scale. And in order to maintain such a tight, brutal death grip on the captive black mind was to prohibit the speech and for the most part, well, speech reflects thought. You know, with the Bible said, the man, what he speaks is reflective of what's in his inside, his heart. The heart is a chakra, the Tiferet is representative of the mind. So the thinking, as the Hindus and the ancient Israelites understood, was generated in the heart chakra, not in the brain. Some kind of deep meditative contemplation took place in that region of the body, in the chest. And they wanted to make sure that you cut that off, because if I'm not going to speak what's reflective of my heart, so to me, I must lie to myself about what I feel. Or at worst, I can try to wrestle and fight and have this inner struggle with expressing my a false nature and have a true nature within. And they wanted us to constantly be conflicted as how to deal with in modern psychological speak of the unconscious and the conscious mind, to constantly be at war with the self.
Right.
And if you're at war with yourself, you can't spend your time being at war with master.
I need to make a quick announcement for the callers. Brother Mean, are you there? Okay. We're having problems. Blog Talk has announced here in big letters. We're currently experiencing site-wide technical issues. Our technicians are aware and are working to fix as soon as possible. We're very sorry for this inconvenience. So I hope that we can still be heard. You remember the time we did an entire show and there was no audio? So everybody in the chat room, those listening live on the browser, we're about to go into the last few minutes of the broadcast. So you'll need to call in at 323-580-5707 to hear the remainder. Otherwise, you can catch it in the archive. And remember, you can catch us on Facebook at facebook.com/ Beyond the Book. Again, the number is 323-580-5707. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Ezra Aharon, author of Pawn Sovereignty and Sovereign Evolution. Join me on Friday, September 7th, 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Central Time, as I will join the African Conversations with the great host, Charles Williams. We'll discuss current events and topics from both my books. Hope you'll join us. and I'll see you then. This is Ezra Aharon, author on Sovereignty and Sovereign Evolution.
All right, welcome back. African Knowledge Blender Book Club. Tonight's feature is Life of the Natural Slave by Frederick Douglass. And we're still in the first chapter. You had some more remarks, I think, Jonathan, that you were still speaking about. I think you got distracted by the time.
No, I was just talking about the... I was just listening to what you were reading and how it began to, you know, to strike me as very interesting. That, like I said, a lot of it was very mental. You know, the trauma-based mind control that we went through was very much apparent then. And the interesting thing is that we have successfully passed that down. It's the reason why you could make the comment that this will not be, you know, a series that will be very popular, because it is discussing times that we want to say is, you know, back then, and, you know, it doesn't apply anymore, let's move on, so on and so forth. Whatever slogans that we need to say to ourselves so that we can deny our responsibility to answer these atrocities that have been committed against our ancestors, but at the same time we'll say that, you know, we should honor the ancestors. Well, let's be about that, you know. Until we really learn of those atrocities, you know, in firsthand, then how can we honor them if they've taken the time to tell us and we won't listen, you know, because it just makes me so nervous and it just makes me so sad, and I just don't want to hear about that. And, you know, it's the post-racial America, and this just makes me want to vote today. Can I absentee vote right now?
You know, oh, we're going to get on voting. Oh, the program with Ezra Aharon. He has an excellent chapter on voting and the political pussy.
You're up, I mean. You're up.
Can you hear me?
Press the one, you're up.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, when he was reading, it was reminding me of something that we hear, not too long ago. It's something we talk about sometimes, where folks say that, you know, my grandfather, I have Dutch in me. You know, these types of things. This thing where you have a slave master being the father that really could. You know, this brings it out in the open that there was atrocity committed. When you actually say the R word, the rape word, you know, people don't want to acknowledge that. So they talk about. My great great grandfather was Dutch. Well, my great great, but that's what your great 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 grandfather was doing,
right?
Is that? And by the same token, if you have somebody more recent, there may be somebody with just their father or their mother, you know. But it's the same thing where you're they're still going by the system. They're not bucking the system for the benefit of their kids or for the purpose of black liberation or black freedom, even up to now. You know, that same type of thing is going on somehow now, even though people have mixed marriages and it's still a victim-master relationship in some way.
Right. That's it. Absolutely agree.
Right. But we almost through with this chapter. Just make a
You only have about 6 minutes.
Okay. Well, you know, we're not going to finish the whole thing because we have to save something for people to read on their own.
Right.
You know. But I'm going to go ahead and read another paragraph.
Okay.
Every year brings with it a multitude of this class of slaves, which it was doubtless in consequence of a knowledge of this fact that one great statesman of the South predicted the downfall of slavery by the inevitable laws of population. Whether this prophecy is ever fulfilled or not, it is nevertheless plain that a very different-looking class of people are springing up in the South, and we are now held in slavery from those originally brought to this country from Africa. And if their increase will do no other good, it will do away with the force of the argument that God cursed Ham, and therefore American slavery is right. If the lineal descendants of Ham are alone to be scripturally enslaved, it is certain that slavery at the South must soon become unscriptural, for thousands are ushered into the world annually who, like myself, owe their existence to white fathers, whose fathers most frequently their own masters. And he says, I have had two masters, and my first master's name was Anthony. And let me just pause right here. He deals with basically how they say, well, if the black man is cursed because with black skin, and therefore he is under this edict of slavery by the European, well, then once the European father's children, and he no longer has the badge of melanin, the black skin, well, then what's the biblical scriptural basis for enslavement? So that basically means he should be set free because he no longer has the badge. But then they just made a man a law that they consider. They said, well, the children of slave women shall in all cases follow the conditions of their mothers. See, that's the guarantee that the slavery persists in spite of their interpretation of the Ham incident from Genesis chapter 9. And so basically he's going over some of their intellectual gymnastics to justify their own wickedness.
May I interject something?
Yes.
Another thing that I think that he sort of points out, well, he's implying it here, is that if you were light-skinned, it was no question that you were a slave. I think that there's this big misconception that, if you were light-skinned, you were, I don't know, close to the master or in the house with the AC and the drink. However, that was not the case for Frederick Douglass and for many who were enslaved, is that if you were light-skinned, everybody knew pretty much how you came into existence, and it was no doubt that you were a slave, and most likely you were working in the field anyway because the mistress didn't want you around in her house anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to point that out, that there's this big misconception out here, and I know Harry Jacobs is going to deal with that as well, that, you know, if you were light-skinned, that you were treated, you know, quote-unquote, better than the darker slaves, but that was never the case at all. So I'm done with that. I just want to interject that.
You're right. Frederick Douglass was light-skinned.
Yes.
Right.
And he was in the, well, younger world. Y'all will get into that. But for the most part, if you were light-skinned, you were in the field. I think there's this big misconception that if you were light-skinned, that you were, you know, in the house and you were all lovey-dovey. No, the mistress, the wife, couldn't stand to see you. So you did all the arduous work. You were out in the field, away from the house. So I just wanted to point that out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. I think a lot of it happened, these kinds of perspectives developed after the war and during Reconstruction, in the division of power and influence in the black community, when maybe lighter complexion Africans would begin to get more favors or different kinds of whatever. I think we're almost out of time, aren't we?
Yeah, you have a couple minutes.
Yeah. So I think that's what happened, and then people just start to assume that they were all house slaves, and they had just wonderful privileges on the plantation, and everything was just better for them. And that was definitely not true for most cases. And there were a few cases, I think.